We're going to use this session to have an introduction to the book of Isaiah, which we will be studying for the next few weeks together. And it helps when you have a book this large and this perplexing, I guess we could say, in some respects, to have an introduction. The size of the book is a bit foreboding because it is 66 chapters. That's the largest number of chapters of any book in the Bible except for Psalms. And then there is also the fact that the content of the book is in poetry for the most part, and it's prophetic, and there's questions that arise as to the interpretation of the poetic figures and of the kinds of things that are being predicted. It helps, however, if we can get an overview of the book initially, acquaint ourselves with the structure of the book and the main themes of the book, so that when we encounter them going through, we will not feel like we're in such foreign soil. Isaiah was, of course, not only a prophet, but he was far more than a prophet. Even as Jesus said about John the Baptist, that he was more than a prophet. Isaiah was a prophet, and he had some other roles as well. As a prophet, he was probably, I think we could say, the most important prophet in the Bible. Well, at least in the Old Testament. He can't be more important than John the Baptist, of course. But in our Old Testament, of the writing prophets, Isaiah would have to be the most important one. There's little doubt about this. We can judge that by many measures. One is that he had more to say about the Messiah than any other prophet did. He is, of all the prophets, certainly the one most worthy of the title, the prophet of the Messiah, the one who told us the most about the Messiah, of the prophets. Now, I say of the prophets because there's one other book that may tell us even more about the Messiah than Isaiah does. Maybe not. Hard to say. And that would be the book of Psalms. I'm judging that by the number of times that the New Testament writers quote from these books. The book of Psalms is the book that is most frequently quoted from the Old Testament by New Testament writers, but Isaiah comes second, and since the book of Psalms is not a prophetic book, we'd have to say of the prophetic books, Isaiah is the one which the New Testament writers made the greatest use of in their writings. And that would certainly make him the most important prophet as far as the New Testament writers were concerned. And that does not mean that the other prophets were not of immense value. Every one of them, as we study them, you'll find they're wonderful books, and every one of them tells us something about the Messiah or the Messiah's kingdom, but none so much as Isaiah does. In addition to being a prophet, however, he was a historian. Some of the chapters in Isaiah give us bits of history. Chapter 7 has a little bit of a historical bit in it, but principally, chapters 36 through 39, those four chapters, are nothing but historical narrative. In fact, they're historical narrative that are almost verbatim, identical to certain chapters corresponding to them in the books of Kings. But in addition to writing the historical chapters of the book of Isaiah, he also wrote some books of history that are now lost. Isaiah is named as the author of at least a couple of books that are historical in nature. So he wrote not only a prophetic book, which has survived, but a couple of historical books that have not survived to this present time. We read of them, for example, in 2 Chronicles 26:22. 2 Chronicles chapter 26 and verse 22 says, "Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, the first to the last, the prophet Isaiah, the son of Amoz, wrote." Now, they certainly aren't found in the book of Isaiah, but it does say that Isaiah wrote the rest of the acts of Uzziah. Well, actually, none of the acts of Uzziah are mentioned in the book of Isaiah, so there must have been another book written by the prophet which chronicled the acts of that king. There's another reference to Isaiah writing history in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 and verse 32. 2 Chronicles 32:32 says, "Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his goodness, indeed they are written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, and in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel." Now the word "and" is in italics, which means it's not in the Hebrew, so it may be speaking of only one book, or possibly two. One is the book of the vision of the prophet Isaiah, That could easily be a reference to our book of Isaiah. Because the first words in the book of Isaiah, as we have it, are the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos. So the book of Isaiah could be called the book of the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which is mentioned in 2 Chronicles 32:32. But there's also reference, it says, in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel, which apparently is also from Isaiah's pen, though it can hardly be a reference to the book of Isaiah, because it is not the book of Isaiah, as we have it, is not a book about the kings of Judah and Israel. So it would appear that Isaiah wrote, in addition to the book that we have bearing his name, we have lost history books, one that contains the works of Uzziah, and another that was about the kings of Judah and Israel in general, which these do not correspond to any surviving books. But they tell us that Isaiah was, in addition to being a writer of prophecy, and the most important one of them all, he was also a major historian of the period of the kings. And it takes different talents to be a historian than to be a prophet. But Isaiah apparently had both gifts. Now, in addition to this, Isaiah was an excellent poet. Most of the book of Isaiah, if you'll simply leaf through it with your thumb, that is, hold it and just kind of scan through, you'll see that almost all of the book of Isaiah, with the exception of chapters 36 through 39, which are history, almost all of Isaiah is written in poetry. And you can tell that if you're looking at any version other than the King James Version, it'll usually be set out by the typesetters in the form not of regular paragraphs, but of poetic verse. And they do this in order that we might recognize that certain passages of the Old Testament were written in poetry. And poetry in the Hebrew literature was not characterized by rhyme, as it often is in our own, but usually by repetition of the same thought more than once. Twice or three times, the same thought will be mentioned. And we see this in the Psalms and in the Proverbs and in Job and Ecclesiastes and the other poetic books. This is also very common in the prophets, although there's more of it in Isaiah than anywhere else. And not only is there more poetry in Isaiah than anywhere else in the prophets, but it's better poetry. All Hebrew scholars agree that in Isaiah we have the most cultured, the most profound poetry found in any of the Hebrew prophets. And scholars of Hebrew poetry have said that the poetry of Isaiah surpasses in quality even that of other poets of other cultures, including Homer and Milton and Shakespeare. Isaiah's poetry has been compared favorably against Homer and Milton and Shakespeare, and it's been said that these great poets, who were not Hebrew poets, do not even approach the high quality of poetry that's found in Isaiah. Now, you've read the book of Isaiah in preparation for this class. You might say, no, I didn't get that much out of it. And one of the problems is you're not a Hebrew, and you're not acquainted with the Hebrew figures of speech, it may be, and also, of course, what to a Hebrew is poetry doesn't look like poetry to us because of the absence of rhyme and so forth. But those who have studied Hebrew poetry and who are the scholars give Isaiah extremely high marks as a poet, which again is yet another talent. To be a prophet, to be a historian, and to be a poet require three different sets of aptitudes. And there's one other role that Isaiah played besides all of these. Those three things were his literary roles, in a sense. He wrote prophecy, he wrote poetry, he wrote history. But in his life, he was a statesman as well. That is, he had political significance, even as Joseph and Daniel and some other Hebrews. Of course, Joseph and Daniel differed from Isaiah in that they were politically significant in Gentile countries. Joseph in Egypt, Daniel in Babylon and Persia. Isaiah was similarly important in Judah. And he counseled four different kings of Judah. It has been said that Isaiah was Jerusalem's chief citizen during his lifetime. He was, in fact, related to one of the kings. King Uzziah was his first cousin, it would appear. We'll tell you the reason for saying that momentarily. And therefore, he was of nobility. He wasn't like many of the prophets who just kind of appeared out of some little village or wearing, you know, camel skin, you know, came out of the wilderness or something. He was of the royal family. although not in the lineage of the king exactly, but not too distantly related. His grandfather would have been a king, Joash. But he didn't happen to be in the proper line of succession, but he still would have been of royal blood and of nobility. And that gave him access, ready access to the kings of Judah. And he gave counsel to four of them, and one of them, Hezekiah, took Isaiah's counsel. Most kings of Judah did not listen to the prophets, but Hezekiah, the fourth of the kings that he ministered during his reign, he did heed Isaiah's counsel, and as a result, the life of the nation was prolonged for a century over what it would have been. I'm referring to the time when Assyria was menacing Jerusalem outside the gate, and Hezekiah was being counseled by several different political parties as to what to do, and Isaiah condemned the other parties and said, no, what you need to do is just trust in the Lord. Finally, Hezekiah listened to Isaiah, did just trust in the Lord, did just pray and call on the Lord, and the Lord routed the Assyrians, and Jerusalem survived another 100 years where it would have fallen if he had not listened to Isaiah. So, as a statesman, as a counselor to the kings, as a man with political clout of sorts, or at least the ear of royalty, he at least in one of his cases, was able to prolong the life of his nation by a century more than it would have been otherwise. So he was a prophet, a historian, a poet, and a statesman. This makes him a Renaissance man of his time, one of the great writers of all history and of the Bible, of course. Now, as far as his personal life is concerned, we don't know an awful lot about Isaiah. We know that he had a father named Amoz. And we know that from verse 1 of chapter 1, the vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz. It should not be mistaken for Amos, the prophet, as his father. Amoz and Amos are two different people. Amos was contemporary with Isaiah, but he lived up in the northern kingdom and was not a citizen of Jerusalem as Isaiah was. According to Jewish tradition, we don't have scripture on this, but the tradition of the Jews going way back says that Amoz was the brother of Amaziah, which would have made him son of Joash, King Joash. Amaziah was king prior to Uzziah. And Amaziah's brother was Amoz, the father of Isaiah. That meant, of course, that King Amaziah was Isaiah's uncle, and King Uzziah was Isaiah's first cousin. And that meant that all the kings afterward were also more remotely related to Isaiah because they were all sons of each other. But Isaiah would have been something like second cousin to Jotham and so forth. Anyway, that becomes, of course, less significant because the relationship becomes more remote. But Amoz, we don't know anything about Amoz from Scripture, but the Jewish tradition places him as the brother of Amaziah the king. Isaiah, in his adult life, married, it would appear, since he had two sons. We do not believe they were born out of wedlock. One of the sons, the first of them, is mentioned in chapter 7, verse 3. The son's name is Shear Jashub. Chapter 7, verse 3. Shear Jashub was the first son of Isaiah. And then a second son was born to him in chapter 8. In chapter 8, verse 1, mentions this son's name, Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Now, yes, it's a long name. In fact, amazingly, everyone chuckles when they hear that name. I guess because, for one thing, it sounds so foreign. But remember, Isaiah was a foreigner. He wasn't American. And another is that it was such a long name. But anyway, these names had significance. Both names had meaning. Isaiah, in addition to prophesying with oracles and visions, he also prophesied in the naming of his sons. Isaiah's own name had significance. Isaiah's name means the salvation of Jehovah. In fact, any Jewish name that ends with Yah, Y-A-H, like Isaiah, Y-A-H is an abbreviated form of Yahweh or Jehovah, which are different alternative names for the God of the Hebrews. Yahweh, Jehovah, these are interchangeable names. And Yah is a short form of that name, Jehovah. IAH at the end of Isaiah makes it clear that Jehovah is a particle of his name, and so is in many Hebrew names. You'll find they end with that suffix. Isaiah means the salvation of Jehovah, and etymologically it's not very different from Joshua, which would be pronounced Yahshua or Yeshua. And that means also Jehovah is salvation. The two names are similar in meaning. Of course, Joshua is the name of the Messiah, Jesus. Jesus is simply the Greek form of the Hebrew Joshua. Isaiah had a name very similar to that of Jesus, and in at least one case stands as a type of Christ, perhaps in more cases than that. The names of his sons had meaning also. Shir Jashub means a remnant shall return. And a major part of Isaiah's prophecy was about the Babylonian captivity and the return of the remnant at the end of the Babylonian captivity. This was a prophecy that was not fulfilled till 200 years after Isaiah's time. Yet it was spoken many times in his prophecy, and he named his son a name that called this to remembrance, this idea that God would have a remnant that would be saved. And Mahershalel Hashbaz means haste to the spoil, quick to the booty, or something like that, to the prey. This name probably referred to either the Assyrians or the Babylonians coming quickly against Jerusalem, though it's not entirely clear, because God did deliver the Israelites from the Assyrians. It might even refer to the Israelites being hastily going out and plundering the spoils of the Assyrians once they were wiped out, which we'll have occasion to look at a little later. In any case, the names of the sons were important, and we know this because it says in Isaiah 8:18, Isaiah says, "Here am I, and the children whom the Lord has given me, we are for signs and wonders in Israel." Now, he and his children were for signs and wonders. Now, it should be understood that signs and wonders here do not refer to miracles, since we do not read of Isaiah ever performing a miracle, nor his sons. But a sign conveys information. And his name and the names of his sons were part of his message, part of the information he had to communicate. I said that Isaiah is at least once seen to be a type of Christ, and this is where it is found, because in Isaiah 8:18, where he says, "I and the children that the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel," is a verse that is quoted in Hebrews 2:13. And in that place, it is said that Christ is the speaker. Now, you know how the New Testament will often take things that David said in the Psalms and quote them as if Jesus is the speaker, when in fact, in the psalm, it would appear that David is the speaker about himself. Well, this is because David is a type of Christ, and many of the things David said about himself have a veiled or secondary meaning in Christ himself. And likewise, Isaiah must serve as a type of Christ in order for the book of Hebrews to use this quote that way, because the writer of Hebrews, in 2:13, takes this quote from Isaiah 8:18 and puts it into the mouth of Jesus, where in fact, of course, it would appear to be Isaiah's own words in Isaiah 8 and verse 18. So, like David, Isaiah was a type of Christ, as well as being, like David, the one who contributed the most writings that were quoted in the New Testament. Isaiah and David were the two writers whose writings were most often reproduced in New Testament writings by quotation. And both of those men also served as types of Christ, in that when they spoke of themselves, they often were really speaking about the Messiah, ultimately. Isaiah's ministry, or his commission to ministry, appears to have taken place in the year 740 B.C. We read of it in Isaiah 6:1. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up." And in that place, he was commissioned by the burning coal put to his lips, and God saying, "I've put my words in your mouth," and so forth. He was commissioned to be a prophet. Now, that would seem to be the beginning of his ministry, obviously. However, there are five chapters of Isaiah that precede that chapter. And it is not known whether chapters 1 through 5 are put here out of chronological order. That is, they really were written at a time later, but when the book was finally arranged, they were seen as being a good introduction to the book, and so they were placed earlier than his call. It's not necessary that all the chapters be arranged in the chronological order in which they were written. So either chapters 1 through 5 are positioned in the book other than in their proper chronological order, or else there was some prophesying going on before his commission. That is, some people think that chapters 1 through 5 are actually earlier prophecies that he gave before this vision that he saw in chapter 6. And that's possible. It's possible that even from his youth he may have been receiving visions or oracles from the Lord, but not being commissioned to go out and be God's official spokesman to the nation until chapter 6. We don't know. If we see chapters 1 through 5 as earlier prophecies, then we'd have to say his ministry began prior to 740 B.C. 740 B.C. is the year that Uzziah died. And so we see this commission in chapter 6 taking place in that year. Some have speculated that Isaiah's ministry may have begun a bit before that, maybe as much as 5 years before that, and that it would be during that 5 years that those first five chapters were written. That is only speculation. But that would place the beginning of his ministry somewhere around 745 B.C. We'll have more to say in a moment about the timing and the historical background of Isaiah's ministry. One other item about his personal life, again, we know very little beyond what I've just said, but according to tradition of the Jews, and this is also in Josephus, which doesn't make it authoritative because Josephus was basing it on also traditions, Isaiah's death took place under the reign of Manasseh. Now, if you look at Isaiah 1:1, he mentions his ministry as being during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, four kings in succession. You've studied kings recently enough to perhaps recall that Hezekiah almost died childless. Isaiah the prophet came to him when he was on his sickbed and told him he was going to die, and Hezekiah asked God for an extension on his life, and Isaiah was sent back to him and told him, well, God's going to give you 15 more years. And that story is found in the book of Isaiah. It's also found in Kings, which you've already studied. When Hezekiah's life was prolonged for 15 years, 3 years into that 15, he had a son named Manasseh. And therefore, 12 years later, when Hezekiah died, Manasseh, at age 12, became king and was the worst king that Judah ever had. According to 2 Chronicles, Manasseh later repented. That's not mentioned in Kings, but Chronicles mentions it. But still, by and large, Manasseh is remembered for being the most wicked ruler Judah ever had, which raises questions as to whether Hezekiah would have been better off allowing himself to die childless rather than begging God for an extension on his life, which produced Manasseh. But according to the tradition of the Jews, and Josephus also says this, Manasseh put Isaiah to death. There are various traditions about this. Some are really extravagant and unlikely to be true. Others could be true. One tradition was, and this is one of the more wild ones, was that Isaiah was fleeing from Manasseh in the forest and a tree opened up. And he went into it and it closed around him. And when Manasseh's men caught up with him, they couldn't get him out of the tree, so they cut the tree down, sawed it down with Isaiah in it, and he was sawn in two. Another form of the tradition is that Isaiah, you know, a miracle like that didn't happen, but Isaiah simply, when fleeing from Manasseh, that he hid inside of a hollow log or a hollow tree and that they decided to cut him in half in the log. Another form of the tradition is that Manasseh deliberately put Isaiah into a log and sawed him in two. But one thing the traditions all have in common is that he was sawn in two under the reign of Manasseh. And this tradition is not recorded in the Old Testament, but it apparently is true because the writer of Hebrews gives credence to it. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 37, speaking generically about the various things suffered by godly men in the Old Testament, the writer of Hebrews writes, Hebrews 11:37, they were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were slain with the sword. The reference to godly men being sawn in two can refer only to Isaiah. There is no other tradition or biblical reference anywhere to a man being sawn in two. And since that's not a very common way of executing people, there can be no doubt that the writer of Hebrews is alluding to the strong tradition that Isaiah was sawn in two. There's no other person he could be referring to. And since he states it as a fact that they were sawn in two, he must credit that story with legitimacy. It must be a true story. So, we know who Isaiah's father was. We know who his sons were. We know when he was commissioned, and we know something about his death. But apart from those things, we also know, of course, his general function as a counselor to the kings and as a writer. But apart from that, the personal effects of his life are not well known, or in fact, not known at all. Now, with reference to the times of Isaiah, the historical period in which he lived, it helps a great deal in understanding the prophecies if you know something about what was going on. Isaiah's ministry was about 50 years in duration, it would appear. We're going to estimate, but an educated guess would place the beginning of his ministry, as I mentioned earlier, about 745 B.C. We know about 740 B.C. because that's what chapter 6 refers to. We're going to proceed on the assumption that there was some prophesying going on prior to that. We'll just guess at 5 years. Now, we don't know that to be so. But around 745 B.C., and the last of his prophecies appear to have been uttered somewhere around 695 B.C. These are just estimates with a certain amount of guesswork involved, but it's fairly widely believed that this was the range of the time period of his ministry, from about 745 to about 695 B.C. That's 50 years. Now, 200 years earlier than Isaiah's time, the kingdom had divided. In the days of Rehoboam, we know that the 10 nations to the north had divided off, formed a confederacy, a rebel confederacy that formed their own government and their own religious shrines at Bethel and Dan, and also their own center for governmental activity with their own set of kings. Eventually, the center of Israel, the northern kingdom's government, was at Samaria, a city called Samaria. And, of course, the center of government for Judah was in Jerusalem. And this, of course, was the condition that Isaiah was born into and that many generations before him had been. It was 200 years before Isaiah's time that this split took place. The time of Isaiah's ministry, he tells us, it was during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And that means that Isaiah's life corresponds to the time mentioned in these chapters, in 2 Kings, chapters 15 through 20. 2 Kings 15 through 20, and also 2 Chronicles chapters 26 through 32. Those chapters chronicle the life of those four kings and therefore tell the history contemporary with Isaiah. Again, that's 2 Kings 15 through 20 and 2 Chronicles 26 through 32. Now, the important political things that were happening in those days were related to Assyria. At that particular time in history, the Middle East was dominated by the rising power of Assyria. Under the king Tiglath-Pileser III, Assyria began to expand its conquests into the region of Syria and Israel and those regions. And this period of expansion for Assyria was from about 745 to 727 B.C. From about 745 to about 727 B.C., Tiglath-Pileser was expanding the conquest of Assyria into the region and became a world power. Now, you can see that that first date, 745, is also the date we estimated for the beginning of Isaiah's ministry. And so Isaiah's ministry began right around the same time that the Assyrian Empire began to conquer the region, and of course both Israel and Judah were threatened by Assyria. At one point, out of fear of the Assyrians, the northern kingdom of Israel under King Pekah joined with the king of Syria. Now, do not confuse Assyria with Syria. Assyria was this enormous, powerful nation that conquered the whole region. Syria was a little nation like Israel and Judah, just a neighbor of theirs. But the king of Syria, whose name was Rezin, and the king of Israel, whose name was Pekah, felt that they should form a confederacy against Assyria because Assyria's expansion was threatening them, and they knew that individually they had no power against this great force, so they thought perhaps we should join ranks against them. And even having done so, they realized that their combined strength was not equal to that of Assyria, so they wanted Judah to join the confederacy also. Then they have three nations joined against Assyria. Now, for some reason, King Ahaz, who was the king of Judah at this time, did not wish to join this confederacy, probably because he felt that would bring Assyria's anger against him. Since this confederacy was forming against Assyria, Judah pretty much wanted to stay out of this and not make Assyria have any particular complaints against them to want to come against them. Isaiah also counseled Ahaz to follow this course of not joining the Confederacy. And because of this, because of Ahaz's resistance to the Confederacy of Israel and Syria, those two nations decided to come against Judah and make a breach in the wall and come in and conquer Judah and set up a king of their own choosing in place of Ahaz. All of this we are told in Isaiah chapter 7. And it says in Isaiah 7 verses 5 and 6 says, because Syria, that is, Ephraim, which is the northern kingdom of Israel, and the son of Remaliah, which is Pekah, the king of Israel, have taken evil counsel against you, Ahaz, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. Well, we don't know anything about the son of Tabeel, who he was, but he was apparently some guy that they were going to make as the king of Judah instead of Ahaz. Of course, that would remove the seed of David from the lineage in Jerusalem, and that was something God said would never happen. But whoever the son of Tabeel was, he would be someone who would be more cooperative with Israel and Syria, and therefore they wanted him to replace Ahaz. Well, Isaiah told Ahaz, don't worry about this, this will not stand, he says in verse 7. It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. And he predicted that instead of that happening, both Syria and Israel would be wiped out within a few years' time. Actually, within about 3 years. That Syria and Israel would be wiped out, rather than Judah wiped out by them. This was fulfilled. In the year 732 B.C., Assyria came in and wiped out Syria and crushed it. 732 B.C., which was actually within 3 years of the time that Isaiah made this prediction, Assyria came in and crushed Syria, as predicted, and in the time period predicted. In the same year, Pekah, the king of Israel, though Israel didn't fall that year, but Pekah was assassinated. So these two kings, Rezin and Pekah, who were threatening Judah, were out of there. They were destroyed within 3 years, even as Isaiah predicted they would be. Now, Ahaz, however, did not exactly follow Isaiah's counsel. Isaiah was counseling him just to trust the Lord and not be afraid. What Ahaz actually did was he sent money to Assyria and said, listen, I'm on your side. Would you please come in and wipe out these people who are threatening me? And Assyria did that. They came in and smote Syria. But that was not a good move. Isaiah counseled Ahaz against linking up with Assyria. And Assyria did not remain a good friend to Judah. After they conquered Syria, about 10 years later in 722 B.C., they conquered Israel. 722 B.C., they conquered Israel, about 10 years after they conquered Syria. And then, about 20 years later, they came down and attacked Judah as well, this time under a different king. Tiglath-Pileser destroyed Israel in 722. And another king of Assyria, Sennacherib, invaded Judah later on in 701. Now, how many of those dates you need repeated for your notes? Let me give you the sequence, okay, just so we'll know. All right. The rise of Assyria began around 745. In about 733, Israel and Syria tried to get Judah to join their confederacy, but a year later, or a little over a year later, Pekah, the king of Israel, was assassinated and Syria was smitten by Assyria in 732. Then, 10 years later, in 722, Assyria conquered Samaria, the capital of Israel, and destroyed that kingdom. You've studied that. That should be a familiar date to you. 722 or 721, scholars differ on it, but it's basically one of the more significant dates in Old Testament history because it marks the final destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. Okay? Then, in 701 B.C., Assyria came down and threatened Judah as well. In fact, not only threatened, but wiped out all the villages of Judah and came and besieged Jerusalem. Now, at this time, Ahaz was gone. He was no longer the king. But Hezekiah was king. And Isaiah gave counsel to Hezekiah to trust the Lord. Now, there were two other political parties that Isaiah was in conflict with. When when Hezekiah and Jerusalem were besieged by the Assyrians, there were some in Jerusalem saying that he should placate the Assyrians, that he should give them money, he should surrender, he should get them on his side. There were others who were for an alliance with Egypt, and they were telling Hezekiah to send messengers down to Egypt and try to get the Egyptians to send reinforcements and troops to come up and deliver them from Assyria. So there were two political parties in Jerusalem at this time. One was pro, or in favor of an alliance with the Assyrians. The other was in favor of an alliance with Egypt against the Assyrians. Now this is important when we get to around chapter 30 or so of Isaiah, because this is this pro-Egyptian party is what Isaiah is rebuking here, that those who want to go down to Egypt and trust in their horses and so forth, because there are many, and he says, you know, they're going to fall, and that's, the plan is a foolish plan. Isaiah was not in favor of an alliance with Assyria, nor with an alliance with Egypt. He counseled Hezekiah simply to pray and simply to trust God, and he did. Actually, Hezekiah received a very threatening letter from Sennacherib, and he took it into the temple, and he laid it out before the Lord, and he had the Lord read it. And he said, God, you know, this, we're in trouble. Please deliver us. And that night, God sent an angel out among the encampment of the Assyrians around Jerusalem, and the angel of the Lord smote 185,000 Assyrians and killed them overnight. And when the survivors woke up and found their camp decimated in this way, they withdrew, and that was the end. And again, as I said earlier, it prolonged the life of Judah by 100 years. It later fell to Babylon. But it was because Hezekiah followed the advice of Isaiah that the nation was delivered. So, anyone need any of those key dates repeated? We got them all down? Okay, that was 733 B.C. Israel and Syria joined forces to come against Judah. Yeah, the northern kingdom fell in 722. And then 701 was when Judah was attacked and Jerusalem attacked by Assyria. Now, other dates become important, but they're not within the lifetime of Isaiah. Okay? That was fulfilled basically in the assassination of Pekah and in the fall of Syria to Assyria, which was in 732. Both of those things happened in 732, about a little over a year after Isaiah predicted it. All right. All is klar. Okay, we go on now to talk about the divisions of the book. As I said earlier, when you've got a long book like this, it helps to be able to divide it into manageable pieces for analysis, and I think it'll help you a great deal to look at the structure of the book. There's something remarkable about the structure of the book of Isaiah. First of all, although chapter divisions are not inspired, all right, I mean, we know that Isaiah didn't divide the book into chapters, yet the chapters have been divided according to some natural divisions in the material. There is nothing entirely arbitrary about the chapter divisions. They divide the book into regular transitional parts. There are a few cases where I would disagree a little bit as to the exact point at which the chapters are divided, but the 66 chapters that the Isaiah is divided into really do represent 66 different portions that would naturally be divided, or quite easily divided as it is. It is divided into two segments. The grand division of the book is between the first 39 chapters, on the one hand, and then, of course, the last 27 chapters. Chapters 1 through 39, sometimes referred to as the Book of Judgment. Chapters 1 through 39. Though you may not be able to tell at this point, this information, this particular division, Isaiah, becomes one of the more important things to know about the book, especially in view of modern critical scholarship against the book of Isaiah. Chapters 1 through 39, often called the Book of Judgment, because that represents largely its contents. Chapters 40 through 66, the last 27 chapters, 40 through 66, usually called the Book of Consolation, because of the nature of its contents. Now, there's one thing striking about this, which might be coincidental. If it is coincidental, it's a remarkable coincidence. And that is this, that as the Bible has 66 books, Isaiah has 66 chapters. Now, that in itself is not too remarkable. I mean, had to have some number of chapters, and that it might fall exactly as the number of books in the Bible would be possibly coincidental. However, our Old Testament has the same number of books as the first segment of Isaiah has, 39. That portion of Isaiah that is called the Book of Judgment has the same number of chapters as our Old Testament has books. And that segment of Isaiah that is called the Book of Consolation has the same number of chapters as our New Testament has books, 27. Now, this is not an artificial division. The division between chapters 39 and 40 is an obvious one that every scholar, conservative, liberal, whatever, sees. In fact, so much is it a division that there are many modern scholars who deny that chapters 40 through 46 were written by the same man as the earlier chapters. I'm against that theory, and we'll talk about that later. But that is how striking the division is between the two sections. Many deny that the same man could have written the second segment. It is so different from the first. Now, some people would have reason to doubt that the same God inspired the Old Testament as inspired the New Testament, too. But, of course, the same God was in both books. One thing interesting about the second segment, the Book of Comfort, is that in the exact middle of that segment, it's 27 chapters long, 13 and a half chapters into it. The very middle chapter is Isaiah 53, which is the most famous messianic prophecy in the Bible. One of the clearest descriptions of the death and even a hint of the resurrection of Jesus in all prophecy. When we think of messianic prophecies, there are hundreds of them, but the one that stands out as the most precise, the most detailed, the most obvious is Isaiah 53, and that stands in the exact center of what is called the Book of Consolation. Now, these two sections of Isaiah themselves divide into rather neat subsections. Looking first at chapters 1 through 39, the Book of Judgment, this section divides into seven portions. These are not of equal length, but they are natural divisions. Seven divisions of the first 39 chapter segment. Chapters 1